the Triathlon Show 275. What's up, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. I'm your host, Michael, and on today's episode, I interview Michael Crawley. Michael is a 2-hour, 20-minute marathon runner who has competed internationally for Scotland and Great Britain, and he's assistant professor in social anthropology at Durham University. Michael spent 15 months in Addis Ababa, the capital of Ethiopia, where he was running with a group of professional runners in a project where he was observing their training and their lives. And the result of that project and the experience is Michael's first book called Out of Thin Air, Running Wisdom and Magic from Above the Clouds in Ethiopia. The book is already released, available everywhere you get your books. I have listened to it and I highly recommend it. But we'll get into the interview with Michael and talk about some of the main takeaways regarding the training, in particular of the Ethiopian runners, right after you thank our sponsors, Precision Hydration. Precision Hydration creates electrolyte products that you can match to your individual sweat sodium concentration level. Now that spring is coming, perhaps you are spending some more time doing longer rides and runs. And during such long workouts in particular, you end up actually losing a lot of sodium, especially if your sweat sodium concentration level is high and your sweat rate is high. And in those circumstances, replacing sodium can be really crucial for maintaining a good performance level throughout your workout, because getting too low on sodium can have severe performance impacts, not to mention other things like potentially cramping, nausea, and so on. You can take a free online sweat test on precisionhydration.com to get a good estimate for your own sweat sodium concentration level, and you can get 15% off your order of electrolytes with the promo code THATTRIATHLONSHOW15. And thank you to Roka that you can find on roka.com. For many triathletes, the swim is our weak leg, and it can be really, really difficult to improve our performance in the water just through training alone. So it's good to know that to some extent, you can actually buy performance by having a really best-in-class equipment. And Roka's wetsuits and swim skins are perfect examples of that. The wetsuits have their patented arms of technology that you know of, and these are present even in the entry-level wetsuits. And when you go all the way up to the high-end wetsuits, they have all sorts of additional bells and whistles, including things like special taping to increase the power transfer from your lower body to your upper body to maximize your propulsion in the water. The swim skins also come with the arms of technology, and the textile and coatings used minimize drag in the water. The Viper X swim skin comes with that same special taping technology that connects the movement of your lower body and core to your upper body to increase power transfer in your stroke. So whether you're planning on racing races where that are likely to be wetsuit legal, or races in conditions where you will not be allowed to have your wetsuit and you would be well served to have a swim skin, Roka is a great place to go and shop for the best possible in the equipment categories there. And by the way, don't forget to bring your swim skin even to races you think are bound to be wetsuit legal, because you never know. I made this mistake for the Ironman 7.3 World Championships in Nice in 2019, where I did not bring my swim skin, and then it ended up having been so warm for the last couple of weeks, unusually warm, and it was a non-wetsuit swim. And I did it in my Roka tri-suit, which was fine, but of course I would have liked to have a swim skin on top of that to improve my swim split a little bit. You can get 20% off your entire Roka order on roka.com/TTS. Now, without any further ado, let's get into the interview with Michael Crawley. I'm here with Michael Crawley. Michael, welcome to the Triathlon Show. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. Thank you for having me.
It's a great pleasure. I was just telling you how towards the end of 2020, I listened to your book, or the audio version of it, and thoroughly enjoyed it. So it will be great to dive a bit deeper into it. But before we do, can you please introduce yourself a little bit more and also introduce the project of going and living in Ethiopia, and that ended up with writing the book?
Sure, yeah. So I'm now an assistant professor in social anthropology at Durham University. The book project really came about because I did a PhD in anthropology that involved doing research with Ethiopian runners. So I was interested in basically trying to understand what anthropologists call the life world of the Ethiopian runner. So trying to understand what the world looks like to somebody who is trying to change their life, as they tended to describe it through the sport of running. So looking at it as kind of an economic phenomenon as much as anything else, and as kind of a form of work that people were undertaking. But I've always kind of been interested in, I suppose, running cultures a bit more broadly. So I was interested in the running culture of the northeast of England in the 1980s, when we were producing incredible runners just who were kind of running around their day jobs, I suppose, but still managing to put in 100 miles a week and run phenomenal times and get medals at the Olympic Games and things like that. So I've always kind of been interested in running as a sort of as a culture, I suppose. So I took that with me to Ethiopia, and I always had in the back of my mind that whilst I was doing research for a PhD, I wanted to write a popular book that that kind of told the story of Ethiopian running, because usually when we talk about sort of East African running, I think we're mainly sort of focused on Kenya because people speak English in Kenya a bit better. It's a bit more accessible. It's easier to go there. But it always made me uncomfortable the way that commentators would refer to the East Africans as if they were kind of this homogenous group. And I kind of knew that even within Ethiopia, it's very varied. There's a lots of different ethnic groups, lots of different languages spoken. So it's silly to refer to East Africa as this kind of big group. So I wanted to dive deeper into what Ethiopian running was all about, basically.
Yeah, and you made a point there that you wanted to write a popular book, and we should highlight that. I think that this is not a scholarly book. It's not a book about anthropology, and it's also not a training guidebook. It's a story. It's a narrative, in my mind, at least, as a reader of it. So, and also, to bring your background a bit to the fore here before we go into the actual contents of the book, you're a very handy runner yourself, aren't you?
Yeah, so I run 2:20 for a marathon, and I finished I think the best I finished is seventh in the Scottish National Cross Country Championship. So I went to Ethiopia, I suppose, as somebody who is used to being, you know, towards the front of sort of national championship races in the country that I was from. So it was quite interesting going into a context where I was suddenly more or less the slowest in any race that I entered. So it was a good demonstration that it's all relative. But I think the fact that, you know, being able to run sort of 2:20-ish meant that I was able to at least jump in on some of the training sessions and kind of hang on for a while in long runs and sort of get a sense for what that kind of what the running looked like from within the group, I suppose, even though I wasn't able to keep up on some of the faster sessions, but I was able to do enough to be able to write about it.
Yeah, that's really awesome that you got that experience to do that. But it does bring, you have some funny passages in the book. I remember when you described talking with the bus driver of the team bus, and you asked the bus driver, I think, if he had been a runner, and he said he tried it, but he wasn't fast enough. And then he realized that he was very similar to you, I think, in ability or even faster.
Yeah, he'd had a go at running for about 18 months, and he said he'd run 30.05 for a 10K, and then decided that was too slow to bother continuing.
Yeah,
which is crazy because that's also at altitude as well. So. My 10K PB is 30.07, so he was faster than me, and he'd already given up.
So let's maybe start by discussing what a day in the life of these Ethiopian runners might look like.
Sure. So we trained hard 3 days a week from Addis, and the way that it basically works is that most of the professional runners live in the city. So they catch a bus out to more interesting and sort of varied places to train 3 mornings a week. So on a Monday, a Wednesday and a Friday, we would get up at 4:30 in the morning and then walk down in the darkness to catch a bus to go somewhere to the mountain in Toto or to somewhere that was seen as a good environment for running. And then on the other days, we'd get up, we'd have a bit of a lie-in and get up more like 5:30 and go up to the forest in time for dawn breaking, basically. So every day we'd start with running, so either a session or just running in the forest for maybe an hour and 20 minutes, something like that. Often on the days when we went in a bus, it would take until sort of 11 o'clock in the morning to get back home because we'd get stuck in traffic on the way back into Addis Ababa. So we'd tend to get back home really hungry and tired and then eat a big meal and then go to sleep for a portion of the afternoon. On the easy running days, often people would sort of start running in one part of the forest and then finish up somewhere else and go and meet a friend or something for a little bit or go shopping in the market or something. It was often the running was a little bit more sort of intertwined with everyday life activities than it often would be for runners in the West, I think. But then most of the day was spent sort of relaxing, trying to sleep a little bit and recover. And then we'd go for a second run about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, eat dinner together normally, and then people would go to bed about 9:30 because we'd be up again at 4:30 the next day. So quite a simple lifestyle, really, but training basically twice every day, apart from Sundays when people would usually have a day off, go to church and relax instead of running.
The runners you were training with, the group, were all of them professional runners, so they didn't have day jobs to deal with?
No, so most people, if they decide that they're going to run, then they describe running as their job and they don't tend to do anything else apart from run. So most of the people that I knew, they were supported in their running through a local club. So there's an awful lot of the running clubs in Ethiopia are sponsored by either kind of banks or the prison service or the army or like a cement factory or something like that. But they pay runners, they pay a team of runners basically a salary that is enough to pay their rent and basically live off so that they can focus on their running. So people basically saw running and other forms of work as quite incompatible.
Yeah.
So yeah, they were full-time athletes.
Yeah. And how much running would a typical week include, whether it's in kilometers or in hours? What would that train load be?
Probably better to do it in hours. I think it'd probably be about 2 hours of running a day, yeah, most days. And then obviously a rest on a Sunday. So maybe 12 hours of running.
Yeah.
It's a bit hard with the kilometers thing because, I mean, you read the book, you know how much of the running I describe is sort of in forests that are very densely packed with eucalyptus trees and very steep and rocky. And so an hour and 20 minute run in that kind of environment can often not actually be that many kilometers. So that would sometimes only be 12, 13K in the morning. And then 40 minutes in the afternoon, maybe just 7K, something like that. So sometimes if you translate it into kilometers, it doesn't sound like that much, but because of the terrain and the altitude, it's probably better to quantify it by time, I guess.
Yeah. And I think that's something that this is primarily a triathlon audience, and because of the bike element and different ways of training, we're all used to dealing in time. I think it's in running, the kilometers or miles is very established, but for this audience, it's not a problem to deal with time. So when you had those sessions that you described on Monday, Wednesday, Friday, are there any examples you can give regularly occurring hard workouts that you were doing and that were kind of the bread and butter of the training program?
Yeah, so Monday was basically always a run on a surface that was referred to in Amharic, which is the main language that the runner spoke, as Korakonch, which is basically like a rough road, like a stony, gravelly road. And they described that as being important because the surface itself was kind of built strength in runners because you were constantly sort of slipping back as you were running. And so we would go to that kind of road, which was also very undulating. So just like big downhill sections for maybe 3 kilometers and then big uphills for 3 kilometers. And we'd run between an hour and 40 and maybe 2.5 hours on a Monday morning. And that would be, the coach would set the pace for those kinds of runs, working down from about 4 minutes per kilometer down to about 3:20, 3:10 by the end of the run. So they were generally quite sort of progressive runs, and pretty hard. So I would often, we would always have the team bus would kind of trundle along behind us, as we did these kinds of runs. So I'd be able to do half of it and then jump on the bus basically when I couldn't keep up anymore. So that was Monday. Wednesday mornings would be a speed session. And whilst the coach was quite keen on trying to hold people back and make sure that they didn't overtrain and give them sort of predetermined paces to run on kind of a Monday and a Friday, on a Wednesday, he would let people run as hard as they wanted. So we'd either go to a track or we'd go to like a big grassy field. And most of those sessions were just done on the watch. So 1 minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes hard times six or something like that. They're also kind of sessions that you would expect to see, I guess, in most places. With those interval sessions, they'd normally add up to about 36 minutes of running, something like that, of hard running and then easy jogging in between. And then on a Friday, the only time that we would run on the road in the whole week would be on a Friday morning. So that's something that's quite different, I think, to the way that a lot of people train in Europe and America. So it was very much the case that people would try hard to avoid hard surfaces. But on a Friday, we would go to a stretch of road that was measured with these kind of white posts in the road that mark the kilometers. And we'd do something like 25 kilometers where you run 4K hard and then 1K steady and then 4K hard alternating. So you'd, and the 1K, the recovery 1K was sometimes like 3:30 for a kilometer. So, and then the hard running.
What was 4K hard?
So the 4K hard.
So that would correspond to. Sorry. Would the 4K hard correspond to roughly target marathon pace or maybe slightly faster marathon pace for these runners?
Yeah, roughly marathon pace. Yeah, so like 3 minutes per kilometer for guys who are maybe going to run sort of 206, something like that. But it's at that kind of altitude as well. That's faster than, you know, than it would equate to at sea level, I guess, as well. So those are like really hard runs. Or sometimes it would just be you just do 20K, like 5K, first 5K a little bit slower and then building the pace in each 5K increment. Until they're running sort of sub 15 minutes for the last 5K, something like that.
So I imagine that for you, obviously, you were just trying to keep up and survive. So the program must inevitably have been hard. But how do you feel that the runners that were at the sort of like a typical runner in the group or even the faster runners in the group, how did they experience that sort of program with roughly 12 hours per week and those three hard sessions? Is it something that they, for them, is quite easy to sort of recover day to day, or is it a challenge? Like, how fatigued do they get, and so on? Just sort of how tough is that sort of training program for those runners?
I think the hard sessions could be very hard, but I think they had this very keen sense that you needed to have those three sessions that were really hard, but then you needed to make sure that the rest of the running was quite easy and rejuvenative in some way. So like the logic of the running in the forest is that because it's so uneven and because it's such a difficult terrain in which to actually run quickly, it forces you to run a bit more slowly and to they sort of consciously saw it as a way of massaging their legs by making sure that the angles that they were running at were always slightly varied. So they were always trying to run on sort of a camber rather than running straight up hills, for example. And that was seen, I think, people were quite concerned with making sure that they didn't overtrain. And the way that they talked about that was that they were worried about burning themselves up. That was how they put it. So I think that there was this sense that the slow running that they did on the easier days was something that had to be learnt, just in the same way that running fast has to be learnt and is sort of viewed as a skill. I think they viewed that kind of slow running also as a skill that had to be mastered in order to prolong your career and make sure that you were able to make the best of the hard sessions.
Yeah, yeah. And that using different terrain and non-asphalt terrain and also running on the camber, and like, it just reduces the monotony of running and the repetitiveness of it. So it makes total sense. And a lot of coaches, of course, are using it in, even in Western countries. I think Salazar is famous for having Mo Farah and Galen Rupp run 90% of their training on like on trails rather than asphalt and the track. Yeah. So it makes total sense. And also just the fact that the running is slow means that you take fewer steps, and because the runs are not that long, as you said, and so you get less impact just by the mere fact that you're taking fewer steps than you would on a flat asphalt road.
Yeah, it's more extreme than the kinds of off-road running that someone like Salazar would prescribe for his runners, though. The funny thing about it was that sometimes you'd be running up slopes that were so steep you'd need to sort of use your hands to pull yourself up with tree roots and things like that. So, yeah. So it did often resemble more kind of... I think we often separate this idea of like trail running in the West from like marathon running, and actually most of what they were doing resembled trail running more than it did anything else, which I think is quite interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. When it comes to those hard workouts, so you had a mix there. It sounds like you had a speed run on the Wednesday, on the Monday you had a progressive run building up to marathon pace, and on the Friday again something that was marathon pace, maybe slightly harder considering altitude and everything, but a sort of a mix of intensities there. And there's a lot of talk about what training intensity distributions different sports and the groups of athletes are using, whether it's heavy on the intense side of things or the kind of moderate side of things. But it sounds here like they included all sorts of intensities, including a big base of easy running, and then quite a bit of race pace running, moderate intensity running, but also including that consistent high intensity running. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the interesting things about it was that the way when they talked about fitness, the word that they would use the English word condition when they talked about fitness, even when they were speaking Amharic. But often when they were talking about sort of gaining fitness, they would say condition yetali in Amharic, which means where can it be found? Where can fitness be found? So they're often conceptualizing it not as what kind of training program is going to get me fit, but what kind of distribution of places and surfaces is going to get me fit. So they would think of it, they would think very carefully about where to go to train on a particular day in order to kind of have that balance between intensity and recovery, I think, more than we would maybe tend to think of it that way. Because they also have a big choice in terms of altitude that they can train at. So some days we would go to Entoto because you can get up to about 3,300 meters above sea level there. And you just run incredibly slowly, but aerobically, obviously, it's still hard. But then they could also take a bus down to a place called Akaki, where you can be running below 2,000 meters altitude, so you can run much faster, and it's also about 15 degrees warmer. So often they're thinking about it, they're thinking about recuperation and intensity of things in terms of the places and the kinds of environments as well.
Yeah, that was what I was going to ask you next about, actually, how they use the environment. And so what is, first of all, what is the altitude of Addis Ababa, where you are based?
It's about 2,400 meters.
Okay, yeah, that's pretty high in itself. So you're always going to have a big impact of altitude there. So what is the kind of their belief system around the different places? Because that's something that you describe very eloquently, I think, in the book with about the air and the way they view the air in different spots. Can you describe that a bit more?
Yeah, so that's particularly the way that they talk about Intoto, which is the mountain that's sort of behind Addis Ababa. And they would often talk about sort of this special quality of the air that was at the mountain. And that was to do with the fact that it's sort of known as the place where Haile Gebrselassie used to do a lot of his running. So it has that kind of mystique about it. But there are also a lot of Orthodox Christian churches up there. So people would, it was seen as a sort of quite a special place, I suppose. And then people would also, you know, even people who lived in Addis at 2,400 meters above sea level, they'd go back to their camp, the training camps that they lived in when they were junior athletes. So they'd go back to Bokoji or they'd go to Gondar in the north of Ethiopia, specifically because those places were even higher. So they would, you know, even people who were living at 2,400 meters would go altitude training essentially in up in Gondar, where I wrote a chapter about going to a training camp up there. They have a track that's at 3,100 meters above sea level. So they kind of, there's this real belief that the altitude is going to make them make them stronger, I suppose.
Yeah, and if you listen to any physiologist specializing in altitude training, they would say that you should absolutely not go to 3,100 meters and do a hard track workout. But do these runners still, they do hard workouts, I assume, on that track? It's not just easy aerobic running. They do work hard as well.
Yeah, they do. So I think I wrote about one session of like kilometer reps on a grass track at 3,100 meters where this guy's running like 2:30 for a kilometer up there. They train really hard, and that's like, it was interesting because one of the coach at that training camp, which was sponsored by the Amhara Water Corporation, so like another instance of kind of state entity sponsoring a whole athletics training camp, but he was fluent in English and had studied sports physiology, had a degree in sports science, and he said, you know, if you read the textbooks, this isn't a good idea. But this is what we do, and it seems to be working. So, who knows?
Yeah, I think that's a big takeaway from your book, from the way that they train. And for me, when I finished the book, the big takeaway is that, I mean, the best outcome doesn't always come from just following the textbook. And I think that it just shows how important the psychology, the mindset is. And like, if you can have a place that you believe has some sort of special quality to it, and where the air is special and Haile Gebrselassie used to train there, if I can go to the pool where Michael Phelps used to train, maybe that'll make me a better swimmer. Who knows? But the thing is that we can't discredit these things because they all have an impact. It's not just about the textbook and the physiology. And I think there are so many great examples that you show in your book about just that. Another thing that when you mentioned the comparison to the Kenyans at the start of our conversation, and at least when it comes to the Kenyans, one thing that has been said is that their greatest asset might not even be their anthropometry or the fact that they're brought up at altitude and have trained at altitude for their entire life, but the fact that they're training in a group. And that is something that obviously the Ethiopians do as well. Do you buy into that the group effect is a really, really big asset and a really big factor behind their success?
Definitely. And more than me buying into it, it was the thing that people talked about most in terms of success, that they really had this idea of running success as being collectively produced by the group and that environment. So, I think even more, I don't know enough about Kenya really to make the comparison, but in Ethiopia they have this sense that energy, rather than being something that is kind of stored within one individual body and is kind of contained in that way, is something that kind of flows between people a little bit more. So there was this like a very strong sense that it was important not only to train in a group but to have quite an even distribution of kind of pacemaking responsibilities in the hard training sessions to make sure that they were sharing energy equitably amongst themselves. But definitely the sense that by training in a group, they were able to sort of harness that energy in some way and run faster. So they would, the one thing that I found very difficult to master was that people would run actually in time with each other. So they would sync up their steps as they were running, and run in a single file line when we were running on asphalt in a way that was designed specifically to minimize energy expenditure and to sort of almost mimic the way that cyclists, would approach a team time trial or something like that. So there was this very, very keen sense of energy as something that was shared and able to be, sort of utilized and manipulated in particular ways by using the group, I think.
And what is the relationship between the runners in the group? Are they all very good friends or are they more like co-workers? Because they're also competitors. They're competing for the possibility to go abroad and race for big money and also for just national honors on the national racing circuit and so on. So how does that how does that relationship work between them?
That's a very good question. It can be tricky sometimes. As you say, you know, there's this very, very strong sense that that success can only be produced by working together. So that's like a given. But then obviously, once they go to races, they're on their own, and they do have to compete against each other sometimes. So the managers would try not to send two athletes from the same group to the same race for that reason. Mm-hmm. But it's also true that in order to get noticed by the manager in the first place to get sent abroad, you have to be performing in training in a way that that doesn't fit with this idea that everyone works together and grows together and that, that there's no competition in training. So that there is this kind of underlying tension where what everyone talks about is the importance of working together and being friends and everything. But like, there is this kind of slight tension underneath that. So I describe an argument in the book that comes about because somebody has been seen as going faster than the coach asked them to run in training about a week and a half before one of the stronger marathon runners was due to go to a race. And he saw that as a deliberate sort of attack on him or like attempt to make him weaker before a race. And that was like a big argument that happened. But it rarely broke out like that. Usually people were very cooperative and there were some very, very strong friendships within the group. But I suppose with anything where the group is like 30 people, there's sort of smaller groups of friends within that. So groups of like four or five people who would meet up to go training on the easier days as well. But it was generally, yeah. In spite of the few arguments that did happen in that way, it was generally a really nice kind of supportive environment, I found. Especially with me as well. They were very, I wasn't sure how they were going to react to me being there, but even though they couldn't really understand why I wanted to train so hard when I could only run sort of 220 for a marathon, was never going to make any money. Once they saw that I'd been, you know, just kind of remaining committed to getting up super early every day and going out with them and trying my hardest, there was a sort of respect there by the end of the time that I was there, I think. And that was a respect that came from doing the running with them. So that sense of like social cohesion, yeah, that comes with doing something together, I think is quite strong.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I'm sure that the fact that you learned the language in just 15 months as well of being there also would have contributed to some respect from the group. That's very impressive.
Yeah, I think that definitely helps. My Amharic's not amazing, but I speak quite a good specific running-based Amharic, I would say.
Yeah.
I'm able to talk about training sessions and things like that in a lot of detail. Yeah. That definitely helped.
What about the psychology and the mindset of the runners? Can you talk about that and maybe in terms of how it might be different from a typical Western runner?
Yeah, so I think the main way it's different is that people didn't really seem to have a sense that they believed that there was any such thing as talent in running or kind of genetic ability. So everyone saw running as something that there was a process of adaptation, basically, was how they described it. So the word that they used for training in Amharic was limamit, which literally means adaptation, and which basically was a word that implied that becoming an elite or world-class runner basically just involved allowing yourself the time and putting yourself in the situation where you could adapt to the training that you needed to do to get to that level. So I think psychologically, often with runners in the West, we have this quite clear sense of what our limitations are and roughly, you know, what our physiological parameters might be. People pay to get physiological testing that would sort of tell them roughly where their limits are. In Ethiopia, most people believe that their limit is becoming a world-class athlete. So they believe that there's kind of something inside themselves that just needs to be kind of released through their running. So that's connected as well, I think, to kind of religious beliefs, especially amongst Ethiopian Orthodox Christians, that they kind of believe that they might, if they train hard, then God might kind of elect them to this position of kind of transcendent athletic ability. So I think there was an obvious sense in which some of the runners were more talented than the others, but I think this belief that anyone can do it obviously helps quite a lot psychologically. But also the religious belief in something that I think is quite close to an idea about fate or about kind of predetermination, that when people ran a bad race, they would put that down to God not wanting it to happen at that particular moment and not blame themselves for it. So psychologically, I think that's also quite useful, this kind of, because it allows them to have quite an open mind to what might happen in the future. Does that answer your question?
It does. What about when they're in a hard training session, for example? Did you find that they might react differently to the hardship of just a brutal workout in some ways, or in terms of how they cope with that?
If someone was having a really bad workout, often they would just get in the bus, which is interesting. So it wasn't, the mentality wasn't always, you know, that you've got to prove that you're hard enough to gut out any session, no matter how bad you're feeling. It was like, you know, if it's not there on a particular day, you're actually better off saving yourself. And that was also something that would happen a lot in races, like I describe the cross-country race that I ran. Loads of everyone kind of set off as if they were potentially going to win the race, and then once people realize they're not going to, they often drop out. So there isn't this sense of like having to constantly prove to yourself that you can get through every single training session. People would have quite a sensible attitude, I think, towards taking it easier on the days where they weren't feeling right. But I think that's like that's the case for sort of individual one-off training sessions. But once people had decided that they were going to be a runner and that was going to be their identity, they would make that their identity for sort of 5-6 years, to have that approach to training that is patient and consistent and committed, I think. So I think missing one training session wasn't seen as an issue, but this having a mentality that was accepting that this was going to be a process that was going to take a number of years, I think, is quite important.
Yeah, well, that is to me as a coach, that really resonates strongly. That is how I would encourage any athlete to think about it as well. Think more about the big picture and the long-term process rather than what might or might not occur as a result of any single session, because that's not much, to be honest. It's what happens with the entirety of the program over a long and consistent period of training. What about if we flip the situation on its head a little bit, and when we would have an Ethiopian coach or runner would come to the UK, for example, and get involved in the running community there and start running, what are the things that they would deem maybe odd or strange in some way, or even silly and stupid?
Lots of things, I think, probably. First of all, there'd be are disgusted at the number of people running on roads all the time. They'd be telling everyone to get off the roads and onto the trails and onto softer surfaces and things. I mean, the running community in Ethiopia looks so different to the running to running community in the West that it's almost like a categorically different thing, I think, because with the exception of a very small handful of middle-class people in Addis, there's not a culture of recreational running. So you're either a runner and you're essentially a professional runner, or you're not running really. So it's really quite different. So I think a coach would come over and they'd be surprised at the way that running clubs work as well, because I often had people ask me what salary I was paid by my running club in the UK, which is because the system is so different in Ethiopia, where everyone is supported by the club and paid a decent salary. And when I explained that you have to pay the running club in order to be a member, they just couldn't get their head around that really. So that's kind of interesting. But I think they would see similarities in the kinds of social lives that people have around running clubs in the UK and other European countries. I think it's there are a lot of similarities as well, but the main thing would be they would be very keen to get people off the roads and onto the trails. I think that would be the main thing.
Yeah, all right.
Also, perhaps speaking of get away from GPS watches a little bit on the easier days of running. There was an interesting, more selective use of that kind of technology in Ethiopia, where it was seen as appropriate for kind of really hard training sessions where you really wanted to objectively know what you were doing, but not appropriate for things like running in the forest where the point was to recover. So if people did have a GPS watch in that situation, it would be to see how slowly they could possibly run rather than to keep a track of how quickly they could go. So they would probably have something to say about that as well, I guess.
Right. So that thing that you mentioned about the money and salary from the club and there not being really non-professional runners in Ethiopia, that kind of speaks to money being a main motivator for them. And that's not to say it in any way as a bad thing, but it's probably just a good motivator. And it's one of the ways that they can make a decent living in a country that doesn't have as many options as we do in Europe. But can you speak to that a little bit? Like how important is the potential financial impact of running for them, and how big a factor is that in somebody choosing to become a runner?
I think it's a pretty big factor, yeah. I think in Ethiopia there's been, like in many countries, I think there's been this sense that education used to be this route to a prosperous and stable life with a decent job and a kind of salary and a pension and things like that. In Ethiopia, it's kind of there's this sense that education doesn't really lead to that anymore, or that kind of trajectory has broken down a little bit. So running is seen as one of the options of a thing that you can do that really does have the potential of a huge payday at the end of it. So I think that's a big factor, but also that, like as you say, there's with the running clubs, hundreds and hundreds of athletes who are paid essentially to run full time. So it's a viable option for a lot of people to give it a go, at least for 4 or 5 years without any real kind of financial problems. Although I suppose there are opportunity costs of deciding to spend that much time running. But I think that's probably the main thing, just having that volume of people who are able to give running the kind of time and attention and kind of commitment that it needs in order to get to that level, to see if you can get to that level.
Yeah, and that's probably might be the biggest answer to my next question, which is going to be what factors do you see as the greatest contributors to Ethiopian running success? And if I can preempt that answer a little bit, what you just said, there are so many people that are able to run professionally that just through the law of great numbers, you're going to get some people that are just really good and can become really dominant at a world-class level. That's probably going to be one of those factors, having that opportunity, even though that's probably an opportunity cost for other things. But what are some other things that you see as the the big contributors to the success that Ethiopian runners are having?
I think, well, there's definitely, I mean, that number of people definitely makes a massive difference. And it also means that the quality of like domestic competition in Ethiopia is incredibly high. So if you go to a local race that's organized between the clubs in Ethiopia, you see people who have finished on the podium in major marathons finishing 20th in like a 15K race and stuff. So incredible kind of competitive environment, I think, helps. The altitude must be a factor of some kind. I think the overall environment of the kind of choice of amazing places that they have to run must also be a factor. Like some of the places we went to train, those kind of Karakhanch roads that I was describing that just go on for miles and miles in this amazing farmland, are just, it's really quite an inspiring, beautiful place to run. That can't hurt, I don't think. But also, I think often when we sort of think about Ethiopian running and Kenyan running, the kind of expertise that we think about is sort of trying to test athletes to see what their VO2 max is and various other different kinds of factors. And when Nike, for example, did the sub-2-hour project and things, they were often framing expertise as something that was possessed by the people who were designing the footwear and kind of coaches in Oregon and things like that. I think we need to like pay closer attention to the kinds of expertise that people in Ethiopia and Kenya have, because that I think the expertise that an Ethiopian runner has is an expertise that comes from kind of learning from just observing and running with other people. And it's been passed down from kind of Abibi Bikila when he won the Rome Olympics in 1960, sort of from kind of body to body, I suppose, in many ways, in that people have just kind of gradually built up an expertise from training alongside each other and learning from what previous runners have done. And I think there's a real pride in that from in Ethiopian runners, that they have this specifically Ethiopian expertise as a way of approaching running, and that's got to be a contributor to the success, both like in and of itself, that there's an expertise there, but also that there's this belief that the Ethiopian way of doing things is incredibly effective.
So. Yeah. That comes back to what we talked about a bit earlier, the buy-in and the example there of, if you believe that, for example, a specific place has a specific quality or a specific terrain has a specific quality that will help your adaptation, then that might well be the case, that it will. It's just about believing in it.
Yep.
What do you think that the Ethiopians themselves would say as the contributors to their success, if there are any differences in what they might answer?
They often would talk about hard work, or they would say badem sera in Amharic, which means work properly. It doesn't necessarily mean, which kind of goes back to what I was saying about how people would drop out of a training session if it wasn't working. They don't tend to talk about working hard, but they talk about working properly, which I think is like quite interesting, because it suggests that it's about this kind of overall approach to the sport, as opposed to just valuing pushing hard all the time. So I think that kind of approaching their running in a kind of committed but kind of measured way, I think is probably what they would say.
All right. Yeah. And now that you're back in the UK, what have you personally changed in how you approach your running and or even your life perhaps since returning from Ethiopia?
Well, when I first came back, I used to do a lot of running on golf courses when I lived in Edinburgh, because that was the best way of mimicking the kinds of runs that we did in Ethiopia on the farmland. But I'd say I try to incorporate some of the kind of easy running that I did in Ethiopia, in the sense of doing these kind of zigzag runs where you just go to a field and kind of meander around as a deliberate way of trying to recover from training. So that's probably the main thing that I've brought back. I still do a few of the training sessions that I learned in Ethiopia as well still when I'm here. Yeah, I think that would be the main thing.
Right. Yeah. By the way, how did that time impact your running fitness? You had the opportunity to do a couple of races. What was the result of the training that you did there? Did you see an improvement in your PBs or an improvement from the fitness level that you had when you got to Ethiopia? What happened?
I think when I was there, I was probably overtraining quite a bit. Because primarily what I was trying to do was to keep up with athletes who are significantly better than me for long enough to be able to write about it, I guess. So I think I was sometimes a combination of that and the altitude, probably meant that, that I was kind of overtrained a little bit when I was in Ethiopia. But having said that, having come back to the UK, and kind of implemented some of the stuff that I learned in Ethiopia, I did then run a PB for a marathon sort of shortly after coming back. So I think whilst I was not usually in amazing shape as soon as I came back from Addis, it seems like there's been some sort of kind of it's had a more gradual effect where it seems to have been beneficial in the longer term.
Yeah. And so if we can leave 1 to 3 key take-home messages for amateur athletes listening to this, the typical club runner or triathlete, based on the experience that you had in Ethiopia, what would those key messages be?
I think number one would be trying to approach running in a way that is kind of creative and makes it seem like a bit of an adventure. So sort of actively trying to make running as interesting as it can possibly be, rather than falling into kind of boring routines with it. I think that's very important. I think what I was saying about kind of seeing slowness as a skill in itself is quite important. So trying to separate the harder training from the easier training a little bit more, rather than just doing all of your running at the same sort of speed. Getting out onto the trails and keeping it as varied as possible. I think those would be the main three things.
Right, perfect. And then finally, let's finish off with some rapid fire questions. The first one is, what's your favorite book, blog, or resource related to running or endurance sports?
I'm a bit of a letsrun.com addict.
Yeah.
I think I'm gonna check that every day. But my favorite book about running, I think, is Running with the Buffaloes, about Adam Goucher, and it's kind of I think that's a great book.
Yeah, that one's on my list. I was recommended it several years ago, but haven't gotten to it yet, but have heard good things about it. Next, what's a personal habit that's helped you achieve success?
I don't think I have a habit really, besides that I've always just decided that I'll go running every day in spite of whether or not it feels like I legitimately have time in the day to do it. So yep. Just deciding that that was something I would do. But I think something that I wrote in the book is quite important, which is about this concept of illusio that I write about, which is kind of playful acts of meaning making that we do in order to make something like running seem important to ourselves. So I think I think it's very important to choose something, you know, whether it's running or pottery or falconry or whatever it is, and just kind of properly go for it. I think that's important. Just go pick something to go for with your whole self, I think.
And finally, who's somebody that you look up to or that has inspired you?
I would go with my coach for that one, who's I wouldn't have continued running past the age of about 16, I don't think, if it hadn't been for him. So I happen to live on the same street as a guy who's in his 70s now, but he ran 2:14 for a marathon back in the 80s. And he's the one who made running seem like it was something interesting and important. So I go with him.
Fantastic. Yeah. And finally, tell people again the name of your book. I don't think we mentioned it. and where they can find it and get their hands on it and so on.
It's called Out of Thin Air, Running, Wisdom and Magic from Above the Clouds in Ethiopia. So it's published by Bloomsbury. Where are most of your listeners?
I don't know. US, UK, Canada, Australia, Northern and Western Europe, across the world, really. But Amazon has it.
Amazon has it, yeah. I'm sure there are local bookshops and other places you can get hold of it. Loads of people seem to be listening to the audiobook, like you did. Yeah. That's available on Audible. There's a Kindle version as well. So, yeah, should be quite easy to get hold of
it. Yeah, and I can highly recommend it. I think it was a great, great read. And do you have social media that you are active on, like Twitter or Instagram or anything?
Oh, yeah. Twitter is at mphcrawley. And I think it's the same on Instagram as well.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much, Michael, for coming on the podcast and sharing your experience. It was really interesting to hear more. And best of luck with your continued running and research.
Thank you very much. Enjoyed the conversation.
I hope you enjoyed that interview. As always, you can find the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com with links to the book, of course. And again, the book is called Out of Thin Air, Running Wisdom and Magic from Above the Clouds in Ethiopia. I can highly, highly recommend this book. I really, really liked it. A related episode that you might want to listen to if you enjoyed this one is episode 195, which is called Run Training of Kipchoge, Farah and Rudisha with Matt Fox of Sweat Elite. We did talk a lot about the Kenyan runners in particular in that episode and how they train based on Matt Fox's training with them and observing them. So that was a really good one and a really popular one as well. On Thursday, we will have another Q&A as usual. And then next Monday, I interview coach Emma Carney, who is a double ITU world champion and former world number one back in her professional racing days in the 90s in particular. So subscribe so that you don't miss that, because it will be a great one. And if you have listened for a long time and are enjoying the podcast, a rating and review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts really, really helps out. So taking a couple of minutes to do that would mean the world to me. If you are somebody that is in the search for a good coach or a good training plan, then I would recommend that you go and check out what we have to offer on scientifictriathlon.com. Well, I would say that without a doubt, the best way to improve your triathlon performance is to get a good coach. I know that it's not an option available to everybody, primarily because of budget constraints. So we try to cater to as many athletes as possible and therefore also offer really good training plans that that athletes are really enjoying and finding good success with. So we hope that this allows us to reach as many athletes as possible to get you to train to your best, to the best of your abilities. Big thanks finally to our sponsors, Precision Hydration, that you can find on precisionhydration.com. Go and take their free online sweat test and get a personalized hydration strategy and get 15% off your order with the promo code thattriathlonshow15 on precisionhydration.com. And thank you to Roka, that you can find on roka.com. Check out their wetsuits, trisuits, swimskins, goggles, high-performance eyewear, and prescription glasses and sunglasses, and get 20% off your order with the promo code that you can find on roka.com/TTS. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart, and keep loving triathlon.